Hey, this is David McCall, host of the QTS Experience podcast. This week, I invited a friend of mine, chief evangelist and internet expert Matthias Friedstrom, to join me for a conversation. We talked about a number of things, but one of the most fascinating was this idea of the war of the web. Matthias is talking about how artificial intelligence and machine learning are going to have to be used to help protect ourselves. They'll help us with pattern recognition, not only to keep the internet up, but to help keep you and I and our businesses and our personal lives, for that matter, less vulnerable. It's a fascinating conversation, and you'll love Matthias straight from Stockholm, Sweden. Join us for the conversation on the next QTS Experience. The most valuable commodity on Earth today is data. How we make it, use it, move it, and protect it. My name's David McCall. Join me today for the QTS Experience. Oh, 3, 2, 1. Matthias Friedstrom, chief evangelist from Telia Carrier. Welcome to the QTS Experience.
Thank you very much, David.
This is my second or third time that I get to speak to you. How are things out there in Stockholm? Are you in Stockholm?
It's actually pretty good right now. Yeah, I'm actually in Stockholm. Yeah, you're right. It's actually pretty good right now. As we talked about before, you know, sometimes the weather is good in Scandinavia. That typically happens, you know, sometimes in July and a few times in August. And today is one of those days. You know, we're not, you know, they don't really give us good weather all the time here.
Well, you know, from all the tourist stuff, the only thing they show you is good weather. So it looks like it's always beautiful in Stockholm or Oslo or Helsinki. And yet when I talk to people from Scandinavia, they're like, well, that might be, you know, we might be drawing from the library. That might not be accurate all the time. So pretty cool. Well, I appreciate you joining me today. One of the reasons why I wanted this conversation, as I said, we've talked a few times before. And I really wanted to dive into a few areas since you're, Telia Carrier is one of the largest internet carriers on the globe, if not the largest. You're an evangelist for them. And I'm really curious. In my podcast, we have a lot of conversations around evolving technology. How are we using technology with our products and services to change the world? And some of those big areas are artificial intelligence, machine learning, et cetera. And I wanted to pose those same questions to you and see what y'all are doing in your organization to develop and look forward with the tech that you have.
Yeah, no, I think that's super exciting. You know, these are things we absolutely have to do and we're looking to, and obviously our customers are doing it as well. So, but we as a carrier just need to evolve with the rest of the world. So I'm really excited about this.
Okay. So what are some of the big projects? One of my near and dear things near and dear to my heart as it comes to innovation is as you look at your cable, your IP infrastructure, what are some of the key areas that you guys are developing right now?
I think the coolest one is really still the public internet that, you know, there's so many more things that can use the public internet that we haven't really understood so far, you know. I think private people actually knows everything around the public internet and so on, but I can see now enterprises starting to understand that maybe the public internet can be used for my services as well. And therefore, you know, a lot of our focus is developing service on top of the public internet that exists practically everywhere. And this is going to revolutionize the way enterprises are building their networks. You know, practically before, everything had to go back to the headquarters, and these networks were quite complicated and quite costly, and service providers made the best they could do in complicating them even more so that they could charge for them, you know, and push enterprise companies into long contracts. I think the coolest thing is that the public internet itself can really develop so many more things. And on top of that, practically every country can build their future on that one. And that's something that excites us every day. Of course, the way we can build this and make the foundation of the internet is extremely exciting. And we can talk a lot more about MI and machine learning and AI and what we do there. But I think the public internet itself is such a cool thing still, even though it's been around for probably 30 years. But there are so many things that hasn't been developed that should be developed on that network.
So a lot of people that listen to us may not know what you mean if there's a public internet, there's obviously a private internet. What do you mean when you talk about we can develop the public internet, essentially giving organizations freedom to use the public internet as opposed to private internet? What does that mean to you? Help us to understand that.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, some enterprises are obviously using our network to have pipes between their small remote offices and their headquarters. And that's what we sometimes call as the private internet for them. We build it for them and they are the only one that can use that. Today, when so many things are available online everywhere and everything could be in a cloud somewhere, what you really need is access to the public internet, access to the internet where you can browse your web server and you can find Salesforce.com, you can find Workday, you can find Amazon, you can find whatever you need out there just by having a broadband connection. Could be mobile, could be fixed, but just being online, connected.
Right.
You can do most of the stuff you want to do in an office by just being connected, whereas before you needed a very complicated network to support everything you needed, and all your applications were stored somewhere, and your IT department had to have 20, 30 people just taking care of those servers. That's not the case anymore.
Right. So what gets you as you look at expanding the public internet and bringing products and services? You know, I've heard it called over-the-top services. I've heard a number of ways to describe this. As you look at that, what are some of the areas that are really exciting for you, either now or you know, on the horizon?
No, I think a lot of security stuff that you can buy from there, you know, public internet. There's still a lot of thieves out there. There's a lot of crooks out there who's trying to steal a lot of information and so on. I think everyone knows that. But I also see that the security companies are doing a lot of development through practically AI and machine learning, trying to find all the algorithms, finding anomalies in the traffic path, the patterns out there, and stopping anyone from stealing your traffic. So I think that's something we're extremely excited about here, because most of our customers are saying, you know, is the public internet safe enough for our traffic to be there? And I think today, yes, you can say that it is that. There's a lot of things you can have there. And that's one of the few areas where I'm extremely excited about. A lot of people are doing all their banking on internet, and they should, because these stuff are secure. There are a lot of companies working on that side.
When I have a conversation with security people, there are two big areas that we talk about now. We used to talk a lot about, or they used to talk a lot about, encryption to prevent somebody from accessing your particular data. That is obviously still very important, one of the most important things, but they don't talk about it as much in the last 6 months in light of some of the things that have happened in the States, which is security from the perspective of I want to prevent somebody from stopping the flow of my data. So not necessarily stealing it, not necessarily hacking into it, but just preventing it from moving. It serves the same purpose. If I can't get the information to my truck to ship goods and services or gasoline in the States, which happened to us a few months ago, or whatever, if I can't get traffic to move, I have just as big a problem or almost as big a problem as somebody stealing my data and getting in and interfering with whatever, products and services, money, et cetera. The second problem they talk about is single points of failure, vulnerability. If I can take out that router, if I can take down this geographic, you know, a carrier hotel or something like that in that particular area. And so it's interesting how these things have intersected where a lot of the conversations are about how do I get more connectivity, more routes, not just more routes to that one router, but multiple, you know, routers or geographic disbursement of fiber connectivity, physical devices that they go through. So I don't have single points of failure. I can reroute around. And I can work on preventing my infrastructure or my connectivity from being stopped. That seems to be – have you heard any of those conversations yourself?
No, absolutely. And we actually made a survey in the spring about these type of events on the internet. And we can see that the COVID-19 pandemic have really increased the number of attacks like this, the ones you talk about. Certainly the DDoS attacks, that the ones you referred to when a lot of the traffic is just – in sending to one point and you practically take that point out. You don't want to steal the traffic. You just want to disrupt the service from that part. That has increased probably twice as much during the last year when we invested, you know, United States among other countries. We've also seen a lot of ransom attacks coming in lately where people actually lock a company's computers and they want money to open it again. Right. Those types of things are really increasing. But I also know that the security companies are doing everything they can to work on this. And the good thing coming out of this report that we've done is that a lot of IT managers and actually enterprise managers are starting to understand this. And therefore, as you said, they're much more interested in discussing with service providers and actually many more service providers. I don't think anyone should be dependent on one service provider only. As you said, you know, the more connections you have, the harder it is to stop you from operating your business and the easier it is for you to have access somewhere and can continue to run your business. So I think the fact that the pandemic has caused a lot of extra security threats have also increased the awareness for everyone working in this industry that you can't be secure enough. You know, the more path you have to the internet, the more connectivity you have, the much better it is.
Yeah.
And I think the awareness is going up, and that's a good thing, you know.
It is. It's so interesting that you just reminded me. Somebody had this conversation, and they said, you know, the most reliable hardware vendor we've had, at least for the last decade, is Cisco. Still spectacularly reliable. They were not anti-Cisco at all. They said, but when we did a vulnerability assessment, somebody said to us, you know, every OS you have on your backend network infrastructure is Cisco. And if there's a compromise to that OS, what's the consequence to your organization? And so they didn't get rid of Cisco. What they did was they just diversified in key areas to have a couple, more than one. I don't remember the exact number, but more than just Cisco in their infrastructure in different geographic locations. Well, on the one hand, it introduced complexity because now you need separate inventory, you need separate training, different expertise. I mean, it does absolutely add complexity. In their mind, though, they were mitigating vulnerability. Back to that single point of failure, it surprises a lot of people when they think of the internet. Well, there's a million ways I can access the internet. Yeah, but it all usually routes back to some particular areas. And so you want to have multiple physical paths and you want multiple infrastructure components so that you don't have a single point of failure. And they took it to mean also, I want multiple OSs in my environment, again, so I don't have a single point of failure.
Yeah, no, I think the same goes for all telecom carriers as well. I think we have a dual, at least we have dual vendors in every aspect of our network, both on the optical layer and the IP layer and even on the voice layer. And just making sure that, as you said, you know, you're not dependent on one OS anywhere, you have dual OSs everywhere, and your network is actually bought from two different vendors who in turn buy their components from different manufacturers to make sure that any factory is stopping anywhere. You know, right. Obviously the semiconductor industry right now seems to completely failed anyway. And it seems like there's only one factory in the world that does them. But apart from that, I think, you know, the dual vendor policy that everyone has seems to work. And I think that's now, as you said, spreading over to enterprises who are also thinking over how many sort of services and systems they need to have. And it should be more than one.
Yeah. It feels like these things are, an event happens sometime in the past, an event happened and we realized, look, if we concentrate our manufacturing in these geographic locations and in these processes and procedures, we can streamline the economic model, we can streamline the distribution model, all these other things. And it worked well till there was a pandemic that none of us anticipated. And there are vulnerabilities in the system that nobody anticipated. We can look around now, hindsight being 2020, and say, oh, well, it's your fault. A lot of really smart people around the world worked on these systems. And now that we've realized vulnerabilities, they're going to adjust them. Manufacturing will be distributed in different locations. They'll keep the ones they have. They'll add others. So in the long term, I think it'll be fine. We'll react to these vulnerabilities. Ultimately, it will be fine. But right now, it is lumpy. Somebody was just telling me the other day that they went to go buy a car. I forget which one, but a little car. And they were – oh, no, I remember what. Somebody was telling me they work at an automobile assembly plant here in the area, not far from here, a few hours from here. We saw them this past week, and they said, "Yep, we're on paid vacation for the next 2 weeks at three quarter pay or whatever it was, because we don't have the chips to assemble the cars." And I was like, "You've got to be kidding me!" No, we've gone through all of our inventory, all of our backlog. It's not a matter of not managing our supply chain. It's just this is how the whole world worked, and everybody's delayed.
Yep, no, exactly. We have the largest truck manufacturers in Europe, is Swedish actually, and they shut down their factories this week because of that. You know, everyone has paid vacation for a week, and they hope they can start on Monday again next week.
Wow, interesting time. So as you, because I could go down that rabbit hole, and I don't want to do that. Maybe we could talk about it later. But I know for sure, back to security, that at least my security friends, they are absolutely using artificial intelligence, like most people, or at least if they aren't already, they're getting into that arms race to help them identify patterns of attack, whatever malware it is. It could be ransomware, it could be denial of service attacks, whatever. They're using that. They're also trying to use machine learning. So there's a lot of opportunity there. Not all of them are as far along. Some of them are just getting started. But for all of them, they're bringing these tools along to help supplement a number of things. One, how do we look for things? How do we look for patterns? How do we respond when we identify something? Where are the geographic locations we should deploy some of our infrastructure to? Are there patterns to attacks, meaning are they coming from particular parts of the country? How are they being routed through? So they're using all these tools. So everybody, I'm in the data center business, we're using machine learning and AI for optimizing our backend infrastructure. For you guys, I know that this is a conversation you've had for a while. How do you imagine using AI, machine learning, things like that to optimize your infrastructure, to deploy new services? Where are you on that path?
Yeah, no, we are absolutely on that path in security and in terms of finding traffic patterns around the world, helping companies stop DDoS attacks. That's already implemented. That's something we do really well. What I think we can do a lot better right now, and what we're working on right now, is using all the data that comes out of the network. You know, the network streaming telemetry is just pouring out data from the network, and I would say hardly anyone looks at that data. You typically work your network until it goes down, and then you find out what went down and you replace it and you keep on working. What we're doing right now is we're trying to take all that data and sending it to somewhere in our network where we can look at that data and see if there is any pattern in there. You know, what before an outage, did we see anything happening in our network? And we're right now discussing with a couple of partners in that space who have they've taken samples from our data and they've said, you know, we've actually found some patterns in here and we can hopefully help you to predict where the next fault is going to happen. And that's going to be huge for our industry if we can stop having these outages, because every time there is an outage, it typically takes a couple of hours for a technician to go to site and replace the card. And those are hours when traffic is not flying the way it should. And we want to sort of avoid as many of them as possible. And here I can see that machine learning and some AI as well will really, really help us. We've done some tests, looks extremely promising. You can see that a couple of days before an event in the network, there are some stats and data that starts to show signs of, it could be a laser diode somewhere not having the power it used to have, or it could be something like that. You want to find that before, and then you go to the site, you swap the card before it's down.
Right.
Sometimes you probably will swap perfect cards, but that's it.
Right.
I think one of the problems we have right now is we have two faults in our network. We have too little data around the faults to compare with. Right. So we're actually looking for some kind of components, partners, customers, whatever, to share data with. And we can look at all our combined data and try to find the anomalies in that data. Yeah. But machine learning is going to be big in our industry. We're just scratching the surface right now. But over time, hopefully, we can predict not every fault, but at least the majority of them.
Yeah. In some ways, this reminds me of the airplane industry. I know it's going to sound really weird, but bear with me for a moment. We built these complex, incredibly, ridiculously complex machines. It's easy to look back now and kind of chuckle at them. But at the time, they were spectacularly complex. Mankind has wanted to leave the earth for all of human history. We accomplished this. But there was a lot of crashes There was some sabotage. There was some, you know, we had to learn a lot of things. Systems failed. Over time, we got better and better and better. And then really late 80s, early 90s, as we began applying what we would now call machine learning. It wasn't machine learning, but technology, computer systems to evaluate faults within the systems so they could do predictive analytics. We began modeling systems so that we could model how a plane would fly in certain circumstances. We improved training of the pilots and the operators. Now they're spectacularly safe, knock on wood. I don't want to jinx any airplanes, but they're these really exponentially complex systems, but they've got great tools in them that are evaluating their performance before they're released, their performance during development, their performance during flight. They're ingesting all of the data after a flight. They're looking through all of the stresses, the pilots. They're evaluating the pilot's behavior in the cockpit. Do they take the optimal action? They're then regurgitating and giving that back to the organization to enhance training. So that's a lot of words, but it's just, you can see this transition of these very complex systems that the whole world relies upon and how technology has been applied to them to make them spectacularly safe and using data. I'm sure they'd say that there's more. And networking feels a lot like that to me. Early days, we're just attaching devices. We're building out infrastructure. And part of that is we introduce unknowingly vulnerabilities. But as we're getting better at identifying those, identifying the infrastructure, having it self-report, I'm healthy, I'm not healthy, I'm vulnerable, whatever, here's anomalies in traffic, I think that people like organizations like yours are going to get a million times better. Not that they're not good now, but just really, really good as they learn how to use the data to do these predictive analytics and intervene before there's a spectacular consequence. Or if a if a bad actor tries to introduce something, you have the ability to immediately respond to that and shut it down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We do have a lot of smart engineers here, but they are outsmarted by the new systems by far. We had an interesting conversation just before this call where we were looking at, you know, a new route in our network, and we were discussing how much traffic we should put on that route initially. And the engineer started immediately to calculate and think, and then someone just said, you know, why don't we run that through that simulation tool we have over there? You know, let's the system figure out how much we need. And, you know, 5 minutes later, someone says, you know, okay, we're going to have 1.2 terabit. That's what the network needs on that route. And it took us 5 minutes. Earlier, it would have been, you know, let's have the next meeting next week at this time and see where we are. Yeah. So I think, you know, yeah, tools are coming along in our industry as well. And that's very much, I think your airline industry example is really good, because I think our network is going to be like that. You know, we're going to calculate the best way of running traffic, not trying to think we can think about it.
Yeah, there's a really interesting talk where they talk about software 2.0, and I think this is a case where it could apply. And what they mean by that is some of the problems are so complex because there's so many systems that are coming together. And what some of the innovators are doing in the early days of this idea of software 2.0 is the human beings don't try to solve the problem. They create these tools, and they're already kind of doing it. And they tell the tool, here's the parameters of the problem we're trying to solve. And they let then the program go do the evaluation at light speed and then write the code to solve the problem. And in the beginning, people were like, you're crazy. I heard this from one of the podcasters at MIT. You're crazy. That'll never work. And now it's starting to work. They're taking much faster than human beings with all of these disparate systems, is able to do the evaluation, come back, and not just say, hey, we've detected some of the things. It's writing the code to breach the gap, to solve whatever the problem is, so that then the system can move forward. And my jaw just hit my lap. I thought that's amazing. And I do think it's going to take tools like that as we're plugging in all these different complex systems to help, you know, be the spackle or the kind of the grit that engineers make these really complex systems, but we need something that kind of goes over them to bring them together. And I think tools like software 2.0 are going to be part of those things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm extremely excited about all that stuff. You know, obviously, our industry still hosts 100,000 of people. And of course, I'm worried if that's going to go down to 10,000 because machines is going to do our job. But that's the way it is, you know. we will just see that.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it possible? Perhaps. But if you look at all of human history, you know, we've got tools that make wheels now where we used to make them by hand. And all those people who made them by hand, they didn't starve. They went and they found new jobs. They either became the operators of those systems. I mean, I don't think I'm whistling in the dark and pretending it's going to be okay. I just look at in every place that we innovate, because that's what humans do. We innovate. You know, the vacuum cleaner didn't all of a sudden create all this free time for us. The oven didn't create all this free time for us. Indoor plumbing didn't create, you know, all this free time. We're going to just keep innovating. And I think people, by and large, that want to work will be just fine. So enough about that. What, as you're imagining, besides security, one of the things that we talked about last time that the internet's just exploding with, and you guys are help facilitating, are cloud-based networking, which is blowing people's minds. You know, all kinds of systems and tools that you're helping to enable. Where are you at with that?
No, I think that's an extremely exciting part. I think a lot of enterprise customers are bored of having their own technicians. I think we for sure are one company where we feel, you know, why should we have the servers in our basement? You know, why shouldn't even we as a telco use the cloud? And right now we're practically migrating everything we have in terms of systems into the cloud. And I think that's a fantastic opportunity for companies not having to bother with their IT department anymore, having to focus on what they are doing as their core business and let someone else perfect the servers, making sure they're in perfect condition, always upgraded, perfect load, perfect power consumption, all of that. So I think the cloudification of everything really is just good for everyone. Maybe some clouds have become too big. Maybe that's an issue. I also see a lot of lawyers coming in here saying, you know, hey, you can't store that data. I think this is more of a European thing than an American thing, because in Europe, we're like 40 countries around and people start to talk about, you know, can you actually store that data in that country? And that's created a complete new industry for lawyers in Europe, warning customers and everyone about, you know, oh, you can't really store data there. And if you go to these American companies, they will probably read every email you will ever send, blah, blah, blah. I think if we can set that aside, then I can't really see anything bad with clouds. It's just going to be really, really good for everyone. You pay for what you use. I can't see. And for us in the telecom sector, that's going to be massive. You know, there is traffic, there is cables, fibers that needs to go to these data centers. So for us as well, you know, we can help customers connect these data centers, and it's a win-win for everyone. So I'm super excited about the cloudification of everything. If you just can get the security and the sort of get the legal people to understand how data is flowing and that access to data is not, you know, even if you store it in another country, they don't read everything there. It's just a way of storing it because that happens to be a good place for having a data center.
Right.
If we can come around that, then I'm all for it.
It's interesting. You're talking about exactly where I was going to go, which is on the one hand, absolutely cloud infrastructure, whether it's cloud computing, cloud networking, whatever. If you can, it's kind of like the central station model with electricity. Almost nobody has a power plant at their site. You know, that'd be, I don't know how environmentally friendly it would be that everybody has some kind of a power generation thing at their facility. So we use a central station and we're trying to get, you know, those central stations tied to renewable energy source, et cetera. And now we're trying to do the same thing with compute. But there is the, whether it's with GDPR or in other areas, this idea of data sovereignty, where does the data live and under what jurisdiction does it come? It's hilarious because when you're describing that, the attorneys there, I'm sure they talk to the attorneys in America, because the attorneys in America frequently will say, you don't want to store your data in Europe. They're going to read all your email. They're going to, you know, this is the, how do you drum up business if you're a wolf hunter, convince everybody that there's a wolf, you know, around every corner. And so you stay gainfully employed. I'm not anti-lawyers. But look, there's a legit thing out there about where is the data, Who has access to data? What encryption, what protections are around it, whether it's at rest or it's, you know, transportation? There's also a cost consideration. You know, if I can use the data locally and I don't have to push it very far across infrastructure, generally speaking, it's less expensive than having to move it great distances. I was listening to this professor at MIT. I had him on the show, and he's talking about energy storage. They have invented a what they call a liquid metal battery. So grid level, multiple megawatt, very inexpensive, very safe battery, so that it can take the sustainable energy that's created. Many times sustainable energy makes more power than the grid can consume, so it stores it so that when the wind's not blowing, the sun's not shining, you have access to this storage and you don't have to go to fossil fuel. That's kind of the big idea that they're working on. But one of the things that he talked about that he's really hopeful, and I think this ties back to networking, is they're looking at, there is a lot of investment and energy and science going into how can we make frictionless energy transmission, meaning how can we get, you know, if generating energy, we can do it in Canada very inexpensively, green, whether it's hydro or however else, you know, solar panels up where the sun's always shining, and we can transmit it down to other parts of North America, and it loses almost no energy on the way there. You know, how spectacular. It introduces other vulnerabilities, but that's kind of the big idea that they're working on. And I'm wondering, as we tie back to networking, if, you know, one of the areas I think back to security, if there's a way to harden that data. So really it is not vulnerable, maybe vulnerable to interruption and being transmitted, but not in opening it up and seeing what's in it. And it gives you the freedom to store it wherever you want, wherever it's the most efficient to store it. It's hard to imagine that today, but I think in the next number of years, that's going to be one of our biggest breakthroughs if we can make that happen.
Yeah, I think that would be really good. I listened to a lady talking about, you know, 6G and 7G networks, and she started to talk about quantum physics and all that stuff. And I think, you know, that's touching this area, almost touching teleportation as well. But I think, you know, that part would be really, really cool. There are ways of encrypting data these days and in a quite good way, but not as good as you talked about. And that's something we would obviously dream about, and having something that's faster than fiber and everything. And you're absolutely right. This is one of the major things in our industry. You know, how can we secure the data and make sure that the one that the data is intended for is the only one that can get access to it? Yeah. I don't think we can ever convince everyone that it's going to be 100% safe, but there's a lot of things we can do to make it more safe. Yeah. And really what you talked about earlier with energy, that's, I think that's the major driver behind cloud. I guess you guys in QTS knows. Mm-hmm. That energy is very expensive at some places and it's very affordable at other places, and it's extremely green in one place and it could be extremely black and dark in another place, and that's why, you know, I think cloudification, especially for Europe, is extremely important, because there are places in Europe where you should absolutely build your data center. Mm-hmm. As you said, in Canada, where access to hydro is really good, and there are some parts where the sun is always shining. Today you can build a data center where have a coal factory next place for a data center. So I think the energy and the transport is one of the key things that we need to solve in the next coming years in the telecom industry, where you guys in the data center industry are going to help us a lot.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I love to see it. But on that topic, I know near and dear to your heart, certainly near and dear to our heart, is sustainability. How, as a carrier, I'm fascinated to know, when you guys think about sustainability, what does that mean for you, and how do you implement a sustainability posture?
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the key questions we're discussing here all the time. I think one of the few areas right now we could potentially change is where we store our data. And we do push every data center we work with. But at the same time, people want access to data really, really fast, super low latency. So therefore, there will be still data centers in downtown Los Angeles, downtown New York, downtown Frankfurt, where in reality, you shouldn't really build data centers. They shouldn't really be there. That's not the ideal position for them. Right. But one way is to see if we can build our network smarter so we can store data in more in better places for sustainability reasons. So that's one area we can work with. Obviously, waste management. I would say currently in our network, there is a new box installed 3 times every day. Wow. And I can see that there's a lot of waste around that. We can certainly work a lot more here. But so far, I think the pressure from Greenpeace and others have been much more on the big data centers, like, you know, the Amazons and the Microsoft. They push them really hard to build their data centers in nice locations. I think they need to come to the telecom operators, because I think we can be more green as well. I'm really into all of this. But still, you know, customers are... Money in the end of the day is important, and latency is important, and therefore, you know, yeah, I won't buy that much data from a Frankfurt data center, so let's keep it there.
Right.
So, something needs to happen for this to change.
I have talked to some folks that it wasn't Los Angeles, but it was a similar situation. And we were like, why do you have, it wasn't a large data center, but it was a significant size. Why don't you move that either to the cloud or some other location? Back to kind of the data sovereignty thing, their deal was, look, because this is governmental data, it has to reside within a certain jurisdiction. And so our choice then is to move this infrastructure out of a purpose-built facility that has the resiliency that we need, that while it may not be as efficient as some other things, it's definitely more efficient than trying to do it in a closet in my office. It's got the logical and physical security that we need. You know, it's got here's why we need this. But does it need to be 2 million square feet? Probably not. But this is, you know, we're trying to make this green. And I think that those outliers, Matthias, aren't the biggest challenge. There are those outliers. There will always be outliers. But it's the norm. It's the 75-80% norm. If for some reason you need a facility, whether it's carrier infrastructure, data center infrastructure, whatever it is, if you need that in a particular area that serves the eyeballs that you need to be, the constituents that are in that area, because it's, you know, your high frequency trading, your whatever it is, you're a hub, you're the edge for this agriculture infrastructure or these metropolitan areas, then do everything you can to make it as green as possible. At least for now, while we're on our way to paradise, do that. Have that mindset. Do that as you repurpose before you recycle. When you recycle, follow certain protocols that are adopted by international, not just US, but international standards and policies, so that we don't end up with an e-waste problem. Operate in a certain way that you're cautious with the energy that you're consuming and what you do with it and how you cool. We've worked very closely with ASHRAE, the industry has, to raise the heat standards. And then also one of the things, I know we've talked about this before, is water. But, you know, what other consumables, not just energy, are you using so that you can be responsible with those? I, you know, that's a position of a lot of the people in our industry, not everybody, but it is certainly heavily on our hearts. And then as we look to the future, where can we build and how do we cooperate with all the organizations in this ecosystem so that not only do we have a minimal effect, we have zero effect, if possible, on the environment around us, right? Not just on the energy or carbon, but on the aquifer, on the, you know, the citizens that live near us.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Some data just needs to be downtown somewhere. But as you said, you know, if we work with heat recovery and all that stuff, you know, we can probably build really nice data centers in those areas as well. And then, as you said, you know, the majority of the data should be stored elsewhere. But the data that you consume here and now, yeah, let's build those facilities as good as we can and make sure we don't overconsume water and that we can reuse the heat that servers are producing and so on. So you're absolutely right. There needs to be a combination of everything. We can't just be 100% green and renewable.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Well, there's a path to it. I think to say that it's, you know, I want it to be more than a goal. You know, not just some kind of a marketing campaign. We have to be intentional and serious around it. I think a number of organizations are, and there's growing pressure on them to be that way by their customers, their shareholders, and their employees. But sometimes there's just situations, and we know this. The reality is there are some circumstances where it's not going to be as convenient as others. But okay, so we set those aside. Again, I think those are the uncommon ones, and we should move to make those uncommon and accommodate those, and we move on to the others. I did have a question for you about, ironically, it's not so much related to chips, but the chip manufacturing thing reminded me of it. There are some industries that are contracting right now, supply chains lumpy, things are not growing for them, but it doesn't feel like it's that way for the telecom industry. For you guys in particular, are you growing? Are you in sort of a pause mode? Let's see how things are evaluating. Are you contracting? What's going on in your world?
I think that's a good question. And I think the pandemic has really caused a lot of traffic. You know, there's been a big change in traffic patterns, and people are working from home much more, which of course companies like us who live on traffic growth it's good for us. Yeah. Right now, I think everyone is waiting for, okay, if we now move back to what's called the new normal, which in some way feels like the old normal and sometimes like a new normal. I think all of us are curious on the traffic and is it still going to grow? Have we grown enough? Can people really consume more traffic data? So I would say, you know, the telecom sector currently is in a mode of maybe there is going to be growth this autumn. Summertime is always the worst time of year when people take vacations, enterprise don't consume traffic. Traffic in general goes down. So September is typically the month when everything recovers. So we're tomorrow, I think, the most important month of our year starts. Wow. It's going to be really exciting. But I really think the pressure on telecom, as we talked about, is extremely tough. There are still a bit too many companies around. Competition is extremely tough. Most companies are still making a profit, but the way some companies make enormous profits and some others are scrambling around, it's a bit tough in our ecosystem. And therefore, you know, the way for us to push down our costs was to push our suppliers of becoming even more agile and better, and hence why we may have ended up in this semiconductor, as you talked about. You know, if everyone is pushing on price, then in the end of the day, you know, only one factory in the world can produce them because they could do it cheapest. Right. Now we're stuck, so now we need to go back to something else. But I would say, you know, that the industry and as such is still healthy. There is still a lot of room for improvements in the way we serve enterprise customers. I think we're just scratching the surface of helping them getting into the public internet, as we talked about. But it's a tough competition out there. People expect prices to be lower every month, you know, and always compensated by traffic growth. It's a tough market, but I think, you know, some companies will come through, some companies will disappear. We believe we are in a very, very good position where we are. We haven't really sort of done anything in the enterprise world, so we're a completely newcomer in that area. Mm-hmm. We're world famous for carrier and wholesale, mm-hmm. Having the traffic, but why not serve enterprises direct? You know, public internet is our backbone. Right. Cloud is what we do every day, so let's tap into that part of the world as well. So we're actually really excited about the future here.
It's interesting. I would have thought of all industries on Earth, one of the and I do think this industries that has the best opportunity is connectivity. I started to chuckle when you said, you know, things kind of dip down here and then they'll increase more. Not around my house in the summertime when it's so hot and all of my kids are inside or their friends are inside and all the streaming systems are streaming and, you know, now we've got 4K on everything. And, you know, so we're streaming more systems. It's not uncommon for me to look over and see my kids. They just did this the other day. They've got a movie streaming. One of the Japanese animation by Hayao Miyazaki is streaming on the thing. They've got three or four of their friends over. They're home from college for the weekend. So they got three or four friends over. A couple of the friends are on a tablet while the movie's streaming. They're playing their game. The other one's looking up like five things are streaming at the same time. I would imagine that that growth is just, you know, I just compared even to 5 years ago. That would never have happened. We might have look something up on our phone, but we would have played everything off of our Blu-ray player. We wouldn't have streamed it through all of our devices. And by the way, that was one room. My wife's in the other room streaming something, right? I'm watching a video on how to repair something. I would have thought that it would be much, every day it's exponentially more growth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is tremendous of traffic out there. But actually, during July and August, the traffic is really, if you compare the traffic in April, May to the traffic in June, July, August, it actually goes down. So in some way. But then September is always the best month of the year. We've seen growth of 11, 12% over 1 month, which is, of course, tremendous. But yeah, we're extremely excited to see about it. And I also see the trends as you talk about, you know, people are using their phones every day. They're using tablets, they're streaming videos, they're streaming series. It is really going up.
Yeah.
So let's keep our fingers crossed for the same thing happening again in September this year.
Absolutely. Do any of the big hyperscales that, you know, the big cloud computer, e-commerce or social media, they're also doing maybe not the exact same thing as you guys, but they're funding C cables, they're funding connectivity. Does that impact your industry at all?
Absolutely. It really does. So far, they've only, as you said, subsidized or not really subsidized. They bought, I would say, more or less all transatlantic and transpacific cables the last couple of years have been purchased by the OTTs themselves. And in some way, you know, they represent 90% of the traffic growth over the Atlantic or over the Pacific. So it makes a lot of sense for them to buy them. A submarine cable system is usually it's not part of your overall network. It's a piece of your network that you can really lease from anyone. So I think most carriers are benefiting from these cables being built because we can use them as well. But I would say as long as the OTTs doesn't start to build LAN cables or going, you know, or actually crossing America or wherever, then there is still room for us carriers, wholesalers to still keep up with them and so still support them. But of course, I would lie if I didn't say I'm sometimes worried about the number of dollars they have in their bank accounts and the number of people they can attract and employ whenever they want. You know, sometimes you hear rumors that they will start their own carrier business. So far, hasn't really happened big time. And I think that's not really what they're interested in. I think they have their own business models for everything else. And hopefully we as a carrier can convince them to leave that traffic path to us. But of course, we need to be competitive and we need to serve them the way they want to be served. If we have outages too long or don't answer questions that they have in terms of what we do and how we do it, they might swap us out. So. I would lie if I didn't say I was worried about the OTTs and their way of building their networks. But so far, if they keep themselves to the submarine cable business, I'm fine. You know, if they want to use us on land, perfect. We're here to support them and everyone else.
You know, it's not an uncommon conversation, I think, in all industry. If you're in the data center industry, you know, there was a time when we were told, look, these, you know, the hyperscalers are going to do their own thing. And they've built their own facilities. They still build their own facilities. But, you know, the way things are growing, the speed at which it's growing, the location at which they need agility. Obviously they demand excellence and they demand a design that, if not their design, is a fast follower design. So you have to serve them with, we talk a lot about operational maturity and excellence, you know, for all of those, all the things that we've talked about today. But it seems that... since it's not necessarily core to their business, it's a component on how they do business. You know, if you're social media, your business is attention. How do I get people's attention? If you're cloud computing, it's how do I serve up the data that you're trying to, you know, the solution you're trying to create in your compute model. If you're e-commerce, how do I get goods and services and ship them to you and build a storefront, et cetera? The back-end infrastructure is what supports that, but it's not necessarily their business model. And so everybody kind of watches them. I think it's healthy, we all want to do business with them and serve them and allow them focus on the things that they're expert on and let us focus on the things we're expert on. But you're always just aware. I think that's a healthy thing to do to make sure we're serving them correctly and we're paying attention to what they're doing in the marketplace.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, yeah, the rest of the ecosystem is fine, but these guys need extra attention.
Right. Well, before we go, one of the things that I asked you, and I just read this, I was chuckling, is that we're lucky to have you here because you're going to be a professional golfer. What is the story? What is the story with that?
Yeah, that was absolutely my dream when I was young. And I actually played as a professional in 1 year in 1991. Then I ended up going to university. You know, in Europe, you don't go, if you go to university, you stop your sports. It's not like in your country where you do both, right. Which would have been perfectly fine.
Right.
But then I kind of stopped. I've kept on playing, obviously. I'm still okay.
Right.
But now I'm finally back having some time of it. And I'm still dreaming about that, you know, major breakthrough. And if Phil Mickelson can win the PGA Championship when he's 50, you know, maybe I can do something like that. You know, I heard the other day that Bernard Langer he scored his own age, 64, which is obviously started to think, you know, okay, I'm not that too many years away from having a shot at that. So, I love the golfing industry, but at the same time, only playing golf every day made me bored. I was extremely interested in math and physics and the rest of the stuff at university. So I'm kind of happy anyway, ending up in this position than being on the PGA Tour.
I've played golf when I was younger, and the commitment needed to... I was okay. I would say I was average. I was about the same skill as my friends who had all also just started, moderately athletic, moderately skilled hand-eye. And then we played one time a best ball kind of local tournament, and a local pro played with us. And there's no way this guy was good enough to make the tour, but compared to us, I mean, he was a scratch golfer, a par golfer, maybe a one or two handicap. And we played a pro course. We didn't play the pro tees, but he played the pro tees. And there's such a difference between, and he was a young guy compared to us, his skill and our skill, that I just laughed, said, I'm not interested in that much time and money. I now play frisbee golf, which if you've never played, I highly recommend. It's very addictive.
Yeah, no, I have. I actually have a frisbee set back home. So
Yeah, I play regularly.
I do play that.
I play regularly with my friends, but... yeah, it's funny when I talk to people, just, you know, the thing away from their business, whatever that might be, and that's pretty cool. So what's keeping you from getting out there and playing some local tournaments?
I don't really know. I'm actually starting to see a coach this year or a trainer this year to go back to some of the sort of I'm dedicated this year to become. I've been a soccer coach for my sons for so many years right now, but now both of them have stopped playing, going to university. So I have a lot of free time. So I've decided to give golf a shot again. I'm never gonna play. I'm probably gonna play some local tournaments again, but I probably never will play anywhere good again. But it's just a fun sport because you can always play it, you know, and you can, as you said, you know, you can play with your friends, and if you beat your friends, you still feel really good. So
absolutely. That's I also did dirt bike racing when I was a kid, and I didn't look between us, probably six of us. Of course we would, you know, you're out there against 40 or 40 some odd other racers. If I couldn't beat them, that was okay. But if I could beat my friends, when you get back to the pits and you could give them a hard time, that's what it was. That was all about. I'm very curious. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm very curious. Why don't they do sports and academics at university and in the States?
Yeah, no, we don't have that system here in Sweden. It's sort of super divided. You play golf at your local golf club, and you play football at your local football club, and you play whatever sports at your local sports club. And then university and school is something completely separate, has nothing to do with each other. So, of course, you can go to university and you can still play golf, but you play it's two separate things.
Gotcha.
University will never care about training times and that stuff. So I would say, you know, when you go to university, you're a bit like your first year, you want to become an engineer, you feel, you know, I don't have time for anything else, I want to be a good student first year, and then once you've not played for a year, it's hard to keep up.
Right.
So that's typically what happens with everyone, that either you go on your professional dream of whatever sport you select, or you go to university.
Right.
It's extremely hard to combine the two. here. We haven't developed that system. I love your system over there where you actually play for your school.
Right.
And it's in the school's interest that you do both well academic and in sports. I think that's a perfect setup. For you.
It works well, but not all universities do it equally well. We've got plenty of controversy around that. But the big idea of it's not just American football or soccer or golf, it's also lacrosse. It could be, there's a hockey, there's a wide variety of things that if you and we do scholarships that way. Obviously the state system is different than the European system. And it's different from our public schools and our private schools, but it is a wonderful way to we also do it for the arts. If you're a world-class musician, you can go to school on a musician's scholarship, and you're still going through pre-med, or you're still going through, so not everybody can do it, but if you're world-class in some of these areas, or at least, to the level of the university, it will pay for a lot of your schools. But, the states, we have 50 states, and so it's hard to describe sometimes. Yeah. People from Europe come in and say, why isn't this all free, and why doesn't it work like this? It's just different. I'm not saying it's better, but it's just different. And some ways I love it, and other ways it's a challenge for sure.
Yeah. No, and I think one of the big differences here is, of course, that university in Sweden is for free.
Right.
You can go at the best university in Sweden. It's absolutely 100% for free. Obviously, you need to move to that city, and that's cost a lot of money. But the actual tuition fee is for free. So, and that's why they've kept the academic world completely separate from the sporting world.
Right. Well, hey, look, let me...
In some way, I'm sometimes glad I didn't end up on the golf course, because I've seen so much other stuff of the world that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. So I'm really happy.
And now you're in a spot. One of the things I love about you, Matthias, is as an evangelist for your industry and for Telia Carrier, is you articulate so well what your industry is about. And in particular, I don't know if this is a Swedish thing or your thing, very honest. Look, we're really excited about this. We're concerned and watching that. We're not operating out of fear, but we're watching this industry, these trends, these competitors, these things. And it helps us to focus and adjust, and so that we have a plan of attack to move forward. Or maybe we need to adjust ourselves. How we go about doing business. We have a love to be in this industry. This is how we serve human beings. But we want to be good corporate citizens and good citizens of the earth while we do it. And I love that you're very straight coming of that. So I think we gained, golf lost, we gained by having you here. I do hope you get back out on the course, though. And
I will.
As your sons move on. One last thing. What is it that you guys should be, your industry or Telia Carrier, as you look to the next 3 to 5 years that we haven't talked about, what are some of the things either that you're excited about or you really think you should be focusing on beyond security?
No, I think actually one of the things is the future of the public internet. I'm sometimes kind of worried about that, and we've spoken about it. Some countries are talking about shutting down the internet in their country. Sometimes you hear that we can't really store data like we do, and kind of the future of the internet. Where does it leave us? If everything is going to be this can't leave the state, this can't leave the country. How is that going to work? That's one of the things that I think we in our company think a lot about. How can we prepare ourselves for all this? And the fact that some companies on internet are so big right now, so they almost set the rules themselves. Those are type of things that we are a bit worried about. Going forward, is legal people going to kill the internet because they are going to scare everyone of using it? So when I think it's such a fantastic idea, and the network, when it works, it's just magic. It works really well, and it's perfectly suited for everyone to use.
Right.
I think that's one of the things, of course. Then you always think about profitability in the entire ecosystem, and Is it fair the way we share the money today and so on? We don't need to discuss that here and now, but that's another thing.
Right.
Then obviously the dream of teleportation, that's still around the corner. I would just love to be able to travel without traveling.
Yeah. especially here in the States, you know, we're so large. I have friends and family all over the U.S. and even pre-pandemic, not even necessarily worried about healthcare, but just the ability to step in your transporter and be home for the holiday, kind of all rally around and do that. And you have the freedom to live and work where, you know, you want to live and work.
Exactly.
I'm really curious in your industry how, you know, the satellite constellations that we hear about are going to affect our world. I'm really curious to hear, as you said, the legal ramifications of data sovereignty and where things are going to live. One of the cool things about the connectivity so far has been it's given so many businesses opportunity to compete internationally. When we bring regulation, and I'm not against regulation, but when you bring regulation can impede that. And so I'm hoping we get that right, that we don't, the pendulum doesn't swing back and we get it wrong and really break opportunity for people all over the world to create a better life for themselves. So it'll be interesting to see where we go. Well, we talked about a lot of things, Matthias. I really appreciate you coming on on the program. We'll have links to Tilius Carrier down below and to you and your organization. Thank you so much for joining us today on the QTS Experience.
Yeah. No, thanks. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right. Hey, everybody. If you've enjoyed the program, please like, share, subscribe, and comment. We'll see you next time on the QTS Experience. Have a good day, everybody.